Welcome to Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region. I'm Stella Fong. In this show, I talked to Lynn Donaldson-Familian, who took the photographs for my new cookbook that was released today, Flavors Under the Big Sky, Recipes and Stories from Yellowstone Public Radio and Beyond, Global Harvests, Local Interpretations. It was in this book that really allowed me to focus on the deliciousness of this place. We live here under the vast sky. In this book, the recipes are inspired by my time in Billings, by the bounty I have come across. When I first moved to Montana 20 years ago from California, the foodscape was different. Global flavors were more limited, so I started to create a pantry of spices and sauces that I would use with the bounty I found here. I refocused the recipes I learned from my parents and my Chinese upbringing to create dishes that use local ingredients. I integrated combinations from my travel. Most of these recipes are now found in the cookbook. The book is an homage to my cooking journey, but after living here for 20 years, I nod, if not bow, to the chefs, growers, restaurateurs, cooks, farmers, ranchers, bakers, and all those who bring food to our table. For 4 years now, I've had the honor to talk to those who nourished and nurtured us through their food. In my very first show, I interviewed Shane Ryan, who is the chef from Matt's in the Market in Seattle. He was the Monday night guest chef for the MSU Billings Wine and Food Festival at the Rex with David Mablethorpe. He shared how early in his career he disliked working in a famous kitchen, but the challenge brought him a realization.
Now, when you look back at something as you get older, you just say, like, thank goodness that happened to me. You know, that needed to happen.
And for me, Flavors Under the Big Sky happened. It came to be, and I, for the first time, discovered morel mushrooms with Trevor McFerrin as we wore waders walking in brush.
Oh, I see more.
Do you?
Yes, like over there.
Yep, good eye. Good eye.
I'm with the best teacher.
Oh, that's a good patch.
I actually only saw one. Is there a patch?
Yeah, there's three or four over there, and there's some nice hogs. Them are some real big ones right there. Them are nice.
So when you say hogs, what does that mean?
That's what I refer to as a big mushroom. Sometimes you'll come across a patch, and they're just big, the size of baseballs. I've found quite a few this year that were 5-ounce mushrooms.
In half an hour, we collected a couple pounds of mushrooms. I then took them to Bistro Enzo, where Chef James Honecker added them to a cream sauce to serve up with pasta. In the cookbook, there is a recipe entitled James Honecker's Morel Mushroom Sherry Thyme Cream Sauce Pasta.
So you have a choice of alcohols with morels. The classic thing to do would be port or brandy or maybe sherry. I personally like sherry. This is a Sandemann medium dry Amontillado sherry. Slightly sweet. Doesn't take very much. So we're basically deglazing the pan with that. A little bit of white wine because you don't want to do straight sherry. It'd be very strong. And we'll reduce that just a moment. We're at the point where the morels can go in. You can also saute the morels and deglaze afterwards. If you're going to simmer it for a little bit because they need to cook through. Also, if you've rinsed morels or if they've come in with a lot of rainwater, they're going to exude a lot of moisture. That means you have to reduce it just a little bit more. It's just water. The morels, you know, when they're soft, they're ready to go. But 5-6 minutes. But you could simmer them for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, depending on how much extraction you have or what dish you're doing. These are pretty good. A couple of those were really large morels, so they're going to take a little bit longer.
In the last 4 years, I was always honored to be allowed by chefs into their sacred kitchens to share their passion. Restaurateurs told me what inspired them to open a place where they offered dishes from their heritage. Anlieb Dawood, owner of Saffron Table in Bozeman, shared why she opened her restaurant.
That was one way that I knew that I could put a smile on people's faces, that if I could serve them really good food in a great, cheerful environment and kind of take away their troubles for a few hours, that was enough of a difference for me that I actually could change somebody's outlook on life for a few minutes.
And she changed our outlook with dishes from her Pakistani background. She not only educated her diners, but enriched Daniel Paris from Shoto, Montana, who became her executive chef. Unfortunately, with the advent of the COVID-19 pandemic, the restaurant has shut down. My palate was expanded even more when I met up with Dr. Florence Dunkel of MSU Bozeman Bug Buffet fame, who enriched my life with eating insects, though I discovered I have been enjoying bugs all along.
Okay, well, first of all, we all eat insects, even if we're vegetarian. And we have enjoyed insects. How many of you have eaten fig Newtons? Fig Newtons, by definition, are full of fig wasps because the fig is an inside-out flower, and it traps the fig wasps after they pollinated the flowers that are inside the fig. And so you never know they're there. They're not the crunchy thing that you crunch. Those are seeds when you eat a fig. So that's one insect that we eat all the time.
Meeting her led me to create the recipe for Prairie Surprise Cowboy Cookies that not only incorporate chocolate-covered espresso beans from Brocco's Chocolate here in Billings, but roasted crickets from the Cowboy Cricket Farms in Belgrade. The Jane Sarah recognized chefs in Montana near my time as hosts of Flavors Under the Big Sky. Nick Steen of Walker's Grill, Dave Wells of Chico Hot Springs, Jeremy Ingebretson of Lilac, Mike Muirhead of Moss Taco, and James Honecker of Bistro Enzo have provided inspiration for me and hope that local flavors can have global interpretations, that chefs embrace local bounty in their kitchens. I think that Dave Wells of Chico Hot Springs may have summarized what chefs are striving for these days, as they are Big Sky proud.
Really what we try to do is have flavors that are representative of where we're at. So that when you come to visit Chico, your dining experience is just an extension of the whole experience, if that makes sense. So like you might walk in a trail and see rose hips, and then you can come into Chico and there's rose hips on your plate. You know, the smells of the pine and juniper and sage that are here in the valley. Try to bring that into the kitchen as well, just so that it completes that experience.
The cookbook Flavors Under the Big Sky incorporates those flavors and ingredients I have been introduced to through the show, with the cooking style and inspirations from my own pantry. I am grateful to the Yellowstone County Farmers Market. Swanky Roots, Le Fenil, and Yellowstone Winery and Cellars are just a few producers that create the bounty under our big sky. In the 80 recipes for the book, a photograph was taken of every dish. In the second part of this show, we hear from Lynn Donaldson Vermillion, who took over 5,000 photographs over 4 days. Welcome back to the second part of Flavors Under the Big Sky. We now talk to photographer Lynn Donaldson Vermillion on the phone. Today I am talking to Lynn Donaldson, who is the photographer for my new cookbook, Flavors Into the Big Sky, Recipes and Stories from Yellowstone Public Radio and Beyond. Over the years, she has photographed many of the food stories I have written. For the cookbook, Lynn spent 4 solid days with me while friends, my husband, my sister, and brother-in-law prepared the 80-plus recipes in the book. Thanks for joining me, Lynn.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you, Stella.
Well, okay, let's start with how you got into food photography. You have contributed photos to the New York Times, National Geographic, and Big Sky Journal. Your photos are found in cookbooks, Chico Hot Springs, Seaving Davis's The Western Kitchen, and Jay Bentley's book, Open Range. Tell the listeners how this all began for you.
I first got into shooting food through shooting travel stories. Travel stories are one of my specialties. And so when you shoot a travel story, you have to do portraits, interiors, exteriors, action, and always food. And so it was just one piece of a bigger story I was shooting, but I always loved shooting food.
And then how did photographing for cookbooks begin?
I was asked to submit photos to be considered to shoot the cookbook Open Range by Jay Bentley, who formerly owned the Mint in Belgrade, and then he opened Open Range in downtown Bozeman after the cookbook came out. But the co-author on Open Range is a cousin of my friend Shona Campbell in Livingston, and Shona recommended me. But I would say that after 2001, after 9/11, food and home cooking in most of the magazines I work for became more prevalent, I guess. Like, they just started doing more stories on cooking and cooking at home. And so even before I was asked to do the cookbook, I had been asked to shoot a few more food assignments.
It really is no wonder, because this is what happened with the recent COVID-19 pandemic. When life gets challenging, we resort to comfort and safety, and food provides that. I know that I saw more food photos and stories on social media. Let's step back. Give me some background about your education and your experiences in the artistic world and in the journalistic world.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Denton, Montana. I'm a fourth generation Montana farm girl, and I went to college at MSU. I started in graphic design, and the beginning of my sophomore year, I changed my major to photography, and I never looked back. We didn't even have art in Denton past eighth grade. There just wasn't funding for it. So it was kind of odd for someone who had never even taken a photo class to change her major to photography. But my sophomore year of college, I took a photo class, and as soon as I took that, I was hooked. So I ended up graduating from MSU with a degree in photography and a minor in English. I graduated from MSU in 1993. I really didn't know what kind of photography I wanted to do. I knew I didn't want to do weddings, senior portraits, or wildlife, which are probably three of the first careers people would think of for a photography student to go into. My dad's favorite joke to his friends, my dad would always say, "Oh, Lynn's going to be a bag lady." I don't know what he thought.
Well, you are. You carry your cameras around.
you got that right. I'm definitely a professional tumbleweed. But I knew, like, my senior year of photography, I did two classes, photojournalism and documentary. And in those classes, we did not work in the studio. I was never a big fan of studio photography. I just think it's kind of boring. I love to be problem solving on my feet and having all kinds of different scenarios thrown at me. And I especially love meeting people. For my senior project, I decided to do portraits of Montanans. And so I just went all over the state, and I got to go on so many adventures. Diane Arbus, the photographer, said that a camera is like a passport. A camera around your neck opens up all kinds of conversations, and it leads you to some places that you don't expect to get to go, and you get to have all kinds of adventures. I loved that, and you didn't get that in a studio.
Well, you had a lot of opportunities to discover what was out there and what you wanted to do.
When I graduated, I worked on a movie called Return to Lonesome Dove. Photo and film department used to be identical the first 2 years at MSU, and then your junior year, you would split off. Well, I had so many friends in the film department who got hired to work on movies in the summers that my phone was always ringing, and there was so much production done in Montana. Commercials, TV series, movies, all that kind of stuff was done around Bozeman, and I worked really steadily doing production work right when I got out of college. A man who became a good friend of mine, Steve Mayville, was a featured extra in Return to Lonesome Dove, and he was also a real estate agent and had just sold a house to a man that was coming up to launch a magazine called Big Sky Journal, the editor David McCumber. And so through the movie Lonesome Dove, I got into shooting with magazines through this introduction to David. And once I started doing that, I knew that is what I wanted to do.
I think it comes from a lot of your Montana roots and you're just being open to possibilities, because that's one thing I think of growing up in Montana. It's never the same and there's a lot of unexpected. And that obviously has come into play with your being able to observe, your being able to be flexible, you know, at a photo shoot and seeing things that maybe other people don't see.
Wow. Well, I love that observation, and I think you're right. I grew up, there were 13 people in my graduating class. My parents and I always took lots of road trips, and just traveling around and meeting people with them, I think, is what really got me curious. And I think Montanans, as you say, are very open, and we're curious, and we love new experiences, and we're friendly. And like I say, having the camera around my neck when I started bringing that with me, it just enabled me to delve deeper and explore things that interested me in a really different way.
You know, food has always been amongst my interests. Many years ago, I used to work for a food stylist in Los Angeles. We glistened food with oil. I sorted through boxes and boxes of strawberries for the perfect ones. And I held the smoking cigarette that simulated steam for hot food. What was captured in the photograph was not real.
Share with the listeners some of the changes you've seen as far as food photography and styling goes.
So when I was in college, I actually assisted a food photographer. He shot TAM labels for the national foods industry, and he used a 4x5 view camera. These were just really highly stylized, and we had a food stylist who had a kit with shellac and lard, and, you know, lard is what they used for ice cream, and it was so different. Like, every one of those shots was just painstakingly perfect, and I didn't understand. It was weird. Like, they could add stuff to it that didn't exist inside the can. It always seemed so fake to me, but I learned a lot working for him, and I got to see what magic food stylists could do. And then I guess when I started shooting travel stories for magazines, and food is always a part of travel stories, but I noticed, like, when I go to shoot a travel story, a lot of times I will hinge a travel shoot around a chef's schedule, because food is so important when you travel somewhere, and it's so important in showing, like, the personality of a region. And so the first call when I'm doing a travel story is to the chef. Like, I will organize everything around when is good for them, because when you go and shoot in a kitchen, they are busy. They have to get food out. You don't have a lot of time. And travel stories, for the most part, for the magazines I shoot for, they want real shots. They don't want anything fake. They want what one of their readers is going to get when they sit down at a restaurant. So they don't want you to spend a lot of time making up a very elaborate plate that, you know, isn't going to be like what someone actually eating in that restaurant gets. Because of, I believe, Instagram and iPhones with great cameras and social media, it's just gotten a lot looser. And people in magazines and publishing, even in food publications like Bon Appetit, they want more casual images. So food photography is way less formal than it was when I first started shooting. It's more spontaneous and real.
So you want the chef to be comfortable. And I found that in the shooting for my cookbook, is that I may have had an idea of how the dishes should have looked like, what the recipe should have been, but I depended on you to showcase it in the best possible way. So you're making me feel comfortable certainly helps. What are some of the other hints that you might suggest to the listeners for getting that perfect photo?
I never, ever walk into a restaurant like I'm doing them a favor. They're doing me a favor. That's how I look at it, because that's how it is. And chefs are notoriously artistic, right? And we've all encountered that. I love chefs. I love the energy in a kitchen. I love working around that. I'm an artist. I get it. So you kind of have to approach it as you're entering someone's studio, or you really need to work around their rules. So that is absolutely number one. Always get them on the phone first. You always have a phone conversation, and you tell them, this is what I'm shooting. And as a photographer, I'd say maybe 20% of the time I go with the writer and we do the story together. But normally 80% of the time I'm in there after they are. And that's the most efficient way to shoot, when they kind of have a clear idea of your shot list. Then it's almost like being on a scavenger hunt. And when I shoot a food story, I don't only like to shoot the food. I like to shoot the atmosphere. I like to shoot vignettes that show textures. I love showing textures and colors that are unique to a business. That way, it's really obvious that my shots are not stock shots. They really were shot in the place that we're featuring. Also, framing. It depends on the dish you're shooting. And we were talking earlier about styles in food photography. I'd say at the turn of the century, when Martha Stewart Living was really popular, there was a photographer named Victoria Pearson. And she really drove the style that was published in Martha Stewart. It was very bright and open and airy and very blurry. You would only, you know, they would shoot those images at about a 1.4 aperture, so that, like, maybe one tiny mint leaf on a scoop of ice cream was really sharp and the rest was sort of dreamy and ethereal. And I would say about 8 or 9 years ago in fashion photography, a guy named Jürgen Teller became the star, and he shot everything with a really harsh flash and harsh edges. And that type of style, which became popular in fashion, migrated over to food photography. Wow. So it became ultra real. and almost shocking. Like it was like you needed to squint to like look at those pictures. Everything he shot those at like f/32 with a bright flash, so everything on the plate was in focus. My style is somewhere in between Victoria Pearson's blurry style and Jürgen Teller's really harsh flash, everything in focus. Our eyes see at f/11. That's what our eyes' aperture is. So if you shoot something with a real camera, you cannot do this on a cell phone. If you shoot it at f/11, that's how your eye sees it. If you open up to a wider aperture, you're going to get those softer edges. If you stop it down, you're going to get those harder edges.
You know, cookbook author James McNair was also one of the ones early on that said, let's just do it naturally. We don't have to do plastic food. It doesn't have to be that perfect grape that sits on the plate for you to photograph. So you mentioned this. These days, everyone claims to be a food photographer. So with cell phones, it's easier to take pictures of the food we eat or the food we cook. I still think a camera does a better job because it's dedicated to take photos. What is the basic gear that you believe a person needs to take good food photographs?
I shoot with a Nikon D900, I think is what I have, and a flash. I love using natural light as much as you can with food. I do supplement with fill flash, and the way I shoot fill flash is I tend to not point it directly at the food. I put a diffuser over my flash. I will point it either to the ceiling or to a wall. That makes your shadows less obvious. It makes the edges a little softer, and it looks a lot more natural. Also, if you drag the shutter a little bit, that lets more light into the camera and also makes the images look more natural. So I probably shoot most of my food at somewhere between f/60th and 125th. So I think dragging your shutter a little bit makes the image look a little more natural. Food is really hard to shoot. The book I shot, the first cookbook I shot, Open Range, there's a ton of meat in it. It's very meat heavy. And I know that when the art director was in the process of deciding which photographer to hire, they kept having me email more images of meat. And I think that's because meat is brown and it's not that exciting, and you got to sort of make it look alive and sexy if you can. And it's not always easy to do. But I also use reflectors a lot when I shoot food. Sometimes I don't even use flash. I just have a big round reflector. I love the ones that are white on one side. And my favorite are the ones that are gold and a mix of gold and silver. A lot of times you won't even need to use a flash when you put that up. It just like adds a kiss somehow of sunlight to it. And it just makes it look scrumptious.
A kiss of sunlight. I love that description. After you take the photos, do you manipulate or edit them in any way?
In food photography, 50% of your skill comes in shooting, 50% of it comes in post-production. None of the magazines I shoot for or newspapers want you to go in there and add saturation or vibrance or anything weird or tricky. Most of the magazines I shoot for do not allow you to edit out anything. I always shoot full frame. I don't crop. I think that's another big problem people who are not professionals make, is like, shoot full frame, don't crop in your editing. It messes with the ratios and proportions. So I never crop, but I definitely can make a picture come alive in Photoshop. And editing even more than Photoshop is one of the most important skills for any photographer, not just a food photographer, but knowing which pictures to toss and which ones to work with is very important. You just keep whittling down till you get down to your most striking images. When I do post-production in Photoshop, I try to make it look like it did to my natural eye. One thing that is nice in food photography is adding a little bit of a vignette on the corners, I find. Kind of draws your eye into the center.
No, and I love that because you can see what's really in that dish. And as you said, you know, you want to take photographs as though you are sitting right there looking at that dish. I worked with you for many days to finally choose the final photos that ended up in the cookbook. For our book, how many photos do you think you took?
I would estimate that for your cookbook, I took 1,200 images a day times 4. I bet I took close to 5,000.
Aside from having a good camera, a reflector, and a good editing program.
Oh, lenses are important. I have a fixed 50mm Nikon macro lens. It's amazing. And I also shoot a, I believe it's a 35-120. That's a great lens. But you need to react to the dish that's put in front of you and pick your lens really fast. I bet if the first 20 images I shoot, I just end up tossing, because you got to work your way into every shot. And when you feel it, when you get it, you feel it in your gut.
And your working fast is actually really important too, because the food changes very quickly.
Very quickly.
For us, for the cookbook, we were fortunate to have Nancy Halter work with you, who is an artist here in town. And to watch the two of you work together, you know, with her holding the reflector or her maybe tweezing some herbs onto a plate was really magnificent for me to watch. And I love watching you two work as such a great team.
You know, she would make such great suggestions with color and texture. And like, she absolutely watched that food like a hawk for me.
I wanted to touch that you were talking about being a Montana girl and flexibility and being athletic. You were climbing on ladders, hovering over rocks, dangling over balconies, just about to take a lot of these photos. So obviously you're flexible and you're open to just different scenarios.
Well, that's interesting that you should say that. I, in the last year, have been noticing just how incredibly physical my job is as I'm getting closer to 50. Photography is just strenuous. I mean, you're up, you're down, you're standing in weird positions for minutes at a time, and it is very physical. But you got to be open to other people's ideas. I always tell chefs, or I told you, the author of the cookbook, I told Nancy, if you guys see a shot that I don't see, please tell me. I will not be offended. A lot of photographers want to be in control of the shoot and the situation, and it's their eye. I like people pointing out something to me that I might not have noticed. And I'll tell you, I almost always take that feedback and incorporate it somehow. Every dish, there's an opportunity. I even find myself, like, even when I don't have my camera, when I'm eating a meal, say at the Dash Inn in Lewistown, looking down at my wagon wheel, oh gosh, this would make such a good shot. Well, now I have an iPhone usually on me. I can take it. Oh, and by the way, put your iPhone on portrait mode when you're shooting food. It makes it way prettier.
And prettier is what Lynn makes of photographs. I know with my cookbook, Flavors Under the Big Sky, recipes and stories from Yellowstone Public Radio and beyond, she added the pretty to this book. Again, I am grateful to all those people I've had the chance to talk to over these last 4 years that show so much of the deliciousness and the fabulous flavors we have under our big sky. For the cookbook, I thank Sarah Brown, host of Field Days, who help with editing head notes, Kay Erickson, my food buddy here at YPR, Nikki Ouellette for her always flavorful enthusiasm, and Ken Siebert for all his support and sharing of food stories and recipes. For the realization of the book, thanks to my husband, my sister Jana, and her husband, Susan Carlson, Nancy Halter, and many amazing friends. Music for Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region, has been provided by Parker Brown. Additional funding comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communications on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanians. Thanks to you, listeners, for your support. Go to ypradio.org if you need additional information about this show or Yellowstone Public Radio. I'm Stella Fong.